My name is Mark Friedenberg, and I'm from Bentley College. This is Liz Ledoux from Bentley and Colin Rinesmith from Harvard. And my remark about I'm afraid if I sit down and fall asleep, I got home from China about 11 hours ago. So I'm hoping I'm going to make it. But it's cool to be here. Let's see. So our talk is on iPods in the classroom, and the clincher is that I don't own an iPod. And
I brought one for show.
Liz brought one for show, and who knows. So, all right, let's see if we can come back here. I don't know if this was in the program booklet, but the premise of our talk is that students and teachers are now becoming media producers, and at Bentley, in the information technology course that I teach, we're using audio and video podcasts as a tool for teaching and learning about technology. And in Liz's video production course and mass communications course, students use podcasting and media to analyze the media. And at Harvard, teachers use podcasting to transform the classroom into a conversation. And let's see. So the way we're going to structure our conversation for the next hour and some is I'm going to talk a little bit about the technology behind podcasting and how it works and do a quick demo of a couple of podcasting tools. And then Liz will talk about some of the stuff she's been doing with her class, and Colin will talk about some of the work he's been doing, and then we really want to take time to actually finish the conversation that we started before we started, which is all of your questions that we didn't otherwise get to.
Hi there. I just wanted to also say that we have, I don't know if folks have seen the wiki for this session. It is meant to be a participatory tool. So the address is, it's accessible. I guess we're going to bring it up now. It's available. Do people know that there's a blog for the conference? Okay.
It's like here.
It's actually, if you go to the conference wiki from the blog.
It's right there.
Oh, great. And hit the notes, comments to a specific session link, and then that takes you halfway down the page to our session. And so there's, you know, feel free to edit if you guys want to, you know, add a new section if there are certain things. Certainly welcome your questions if there's things that you are thinking about when someone else asks a question, you don't get a chance to ask it, put it up there. This is what it's for, and just wanted to say that, so thanks.
And we'll post some version of the PowerPoint that's behind me up here probably as soon as this session is over. Just in case you find any mistakes in it. So there we go. Come on back. So that's the plan. We'll see how we do. So just out of curiosity, how many people raise your hand if you have ever subscribed to a podcast using something? Most people have. Who's never subscribed or listened to a podcast at all? So here's the technology overview. This is what I give my freshmen in the technology course I teach. Here are all the words. Podcasting is simply taking media files, making them available over the internet in some sort of a publish-subscribe kind of a model where you, as a media producer, somebody will publish media, and then as a subscriber, you subscribe to it, and then you use a program called an aggregator, which just goes out there and checks to see if there's anything new, and if there's something new that's out there, it brings it back to your device. It's based on RSS, which you've probably heard about a whole lot about already over the time that you've been here, and which is a XML standard for bringing media, representing media, and bringing it down to your devices. The other thing that makes it an interesting topic in a technology course is it brings together ideas of compression, because all of a sudden you want to store your media in a compressed format, so it takes up less space and less time to download. And you showed me your Olympus voice recorder before, and when I started podcasting my classes, I used the same thing, and then found it to be rather annoying because I had to convert the audio twice. One's from the Olympus proprietary format to WAVE, and then one's from WAVE to MP3 before I could post it as a podcast. that would be useful. And so MP3 is a compressed audio format. There's a bunch of different video formats as well, and that brings up an entirely different conversation about standards and why some media players won't play certain formats. MP4 is a standard compressed video format. QuickTime is another, and iPods play MP4s, so when we created podcasts for class, we would convert stuff into MP4. And in order to get a media player to play certain formats, you need these things called codecs, which are really plugins for a media player to play particular file formats. And then you can, depending on how you create the video, you can use the other things that control the size and the quality are the number of frames and and how fast they change in order to get reasonable quality. So, let's see. What's that one? RSS is the underlying technology for podcasting. It's an XML format. XML is just a markup language for text. And whenever you see one of these little XML or the little wave or orange icons, that's an RSS feed. You'll see them on a whole bunch of websites, such as the ABC News site behind me, which makes their headlines available that way. And in order to read these things, you need some sort of a aggregator that will go out and get them. You subscribe to the RSS feed, and when somebody posts something new, you'll usually see, if your aggregator is running, you'll see a little message in the corner that says there's something new there, and it'll go out and get it for you. One of the aggregators that I like to use on my PC is called SharpReader. Mozilla Firefox has an aggregator built in, and there are a bunch of other ones as well. And so all aggregators do is take content from one place and bring it all together with a reader. And so here's a screenshot of an aggregator running on a Pocket PC and another aggregator running on my desktop. And here would be the area. Here would be the feeds that I've subscribed to. When you click on one of them, it'll give me the information about the items. And then when you click on the item, it'll go off to the website and show you whatever the content is for that. So it's really news that comes to you. And here's the ugly part. The RSS feed is represented as an XML file. And the only thing you need to know about that, and the reason why I mention this, is so that when we see what podcasting is all about, you can see the relationship between RSS and podcasting. An XML file is just text as a way to mark up text with these tags. So there's a channel tag, and then a title. This is the ABC News feed. There's a link that tells me where it's coming from, and then each item in the feed has its own set of tags with a title, a link, a publication date, and a description. And those are the tags that go with the items. And all a podcast is an RSS feed with an enclosure tag. So each item in the feed would have an enclosure tag. Myth number one: you don't need an iPod to subscribe to podcasts. You can use any pocket computer or pocket PC. You can, and then all you need is an aggregator, which is a program that will manage your subscriptions and do the downloads and play, and then play the stuff. So here's an example of a RSS feed for a podcast. It looks pretty much like the RSS feed that we saw from the ABC News thing a minute ago. The only difference is that there is this enclosure tag over here, which contains information about the multimedia file that you want to download. So there's an enclosure tag, and then the URL of the multimedia file. This one happens to be an MP4, the number of bytes that it is, and then the content type, which is, in this case, video MPEG for video, or audio/MP4 would be in there. And the reason why you need the content type in there is, any ideas why? What does the content type tell you? It tells you what kind of information the file contains, and so that tells you what kind of a program you can use to open it up. Because if it's a text file or a picture file, you wouldn't necessarily use the same kind of a media player as you would if it's an audio or a video. So that's why you need to specify the content in there. So the good news is, go ahead. Sure. When you post a file, an enclosure, which is the multimedia file, so in this case, I gave it the URL someplace on a web server where this file .mp4 lives. That's my multimedia file. along with it, I need to tell the RSS feed that that file is it contains video.
And that's what you meant by content.
Yeah. And the reason I did that is so that when the aggregator goes and downloads the content, it will know what to do with it, without necessarily having to rely on the extension of the file. And so that's the reason for doing that. And then there's a publication date which says when the thing was actually posted. Now, so the next question that you're probably asking is, how do you actually create one of these files? Because if you have to type it in by hand, it would be a pain in the neck. And there's actually software tools that will do that for you. So here are the steps for making a podcast. That's all the technology overview that you really need to know, is that to make a podcast, number one, you got to record the audio or the video. Number two, you got to convert it to a compressed format, MP3 or MP4. Number three, you got to get the files up on the web server somehow, and that means updating the XML file like the one I showed you a minute ago, and then using FTP to upload the multimedia to the server as well. So those are the big four steps. Not that hard. The question is, what software tools are there to enable you to do all this? For audio, you got a microphone on your PC that works pretty well, but it records to WAV, which is a non-compressed format, and then you have to convert the WAV file to MP3. And there's a bunch of programs out there that'll do that for free. You can search and find those. Another thing you can do is get a voice recorder that records MP3. The one that you have won't. Most of them won't. Most of them will record to WAV. And then you have to... My computer's dying. Let me start that later. Most of them will record to WAV, and then you have to convert it to MP3. Pocket PCs have there's a program for a Pocket PC called Note M, which actually records to WAV, which is one that I like to use on a Pocket PC if I'm doing recording. Some voice recorders will record to MP3 if you look hard enough. RCA makes one. This is one that I have by Frontier Labs. It's a voice recorder. It records voice to wave, but it has a line in jack that lets me record other audio from another device onto MP3. So that's another choice.
So,
voice recorder?
You can use
iTunes to do it. If you go to Google and you type in free voice to wave, it'll work.
Is there any practical way to encode an MP3 on fly, or does it all have to happen after
you? There's some you can find. There's some software that you can use that will actually record to MP3 as you go. I'm blanking out on the name of a PC application that'll do it, but
I would also recommend Audacity, which is a great open source program. It's free. Just download it. Just get it. Download it anyway, even if you're not going to use it. It's great, and it does a lot of great things, converting all sorts of files, audio files, recorders that record an MP3, like. Separate recorders is the question?
Anything that would be convenient as far as not necessarily having to lug a whole laptop or a pocket PC application.
I guess I don't have a name.
Right.
Does the Cambridge guy have a question?
Yeah. I have an iRiver. Okay, I think we could better. That I bought 2 years ago.
Does it have a voice recorder inside of it?
It has a built-in mic and also has a mic input.
I think the mic input jack will record to MP3, but the voice will record to WAV.
Okay. What about Adderall, the Adderall recorders?
I'm not familiar with those.
I'm pretty sure.
Audacity will record. Audacity, which is one that I had on here, is a great audio editor, and you can download it. It's free, and it records and does a whole bunch of audio conversions as well. So this is a great one to play with.
So you can use that with your...
You can use that with your computer's microphone. The problem that I've had is that if I'm teaching a class, I don't want to have to be stuck over there all the time, and so I'd rather get the wireless microphone and then go through the conversion step process afterward so that I'm not tied to that. But again, if you're doing something where you're not walking around a lot, then a solution like this is perfectly fine. So that's another one that's nice is a program called GarageBand. It lets you mix audio and video together. Different audio samples together. So that's good. If you're doing video, a cheapo $20 webcam will give you reasonably good quality video. I'll show you an example of that. You convert it to web. You can convert that to MP4. You can use a digital camera as well. We played around with this little device over here. It's a hardware MP4 converter that you plug your camera into it, and it'll convert the video output from the camera into MP4 directly, actually onto an SD card. Which was really cool because then I could take the output of that and pop it in my pocket PC and watch it. And this device is about $115 at Micro Center in Boston, which wasn't too bad. So we played around with that. In class, I didn't do that, though. In class, I bought a $20 webcam and then used some software conversions at the end. The one that we ended up using was a program called CuckooSoft. There are a bunch of different hardware converters as well. The reason I used CuckooSoft was because I did a trial version of a software package that I could have students use, and this one didn't have any limitations on the number of minutes that it would record in the trial version. All it did instead was put a watermark on the video that said it was trial, but for teaching purposes, I don't really care.
For Mac, the latest version of iLife, as long as you have some kind of microphone on your laptop or computer, should do MP3 directly. And then you can also make music to it to add to it as well. But for video, iMovie is supposed to do it automatically. If you have QuickTime Pro, it will automatically convert video files. And if you're using something like Final Cut with QuickTime Pro, it will also convert it to MPEG-4. So it's a pull down, which I can show you. That's really simple.
And there's another program called Videora, which also does it reasonably well. PC. The next thing we had to do is get the RSS file done, and you can do it the old-fashioned way by hand and typing it all in. I don't recommend it. That's the purest approach. Otherwise, you can use a program called the two I liked. One was called Feed for All, and one was called Podifier. The problem with Podifier is it doesn't create the XML for video, but Feed for All does, and it's a 30-day trial on that.
Is that Mac friendly?
It is.
Yeah, there's a Feed for All Mac version that's actually very nice.
But the newest version of the iLife package includes software that will let you upload it 1, 2, 3. It's similar type of software.
And so these are some screenshots from Feed for All that we used to show how you can specify the feed and then go off and create the items, and then it'll generate all the XML for you. And then there's an option in here that you can upload the XML directly to the server, so it's really easy to use. You specify all the title and the link and the description and the items, and then you enter the item, the description, figure out how many bytes it is, and then send it up to the server, and it just goes. So that's the easy way to do it. And hopefully it works. And it generates all this stuff for you.
Question?
Sure.
Yeah.
All you need is a web server anywhere. You don't need anything special. The server doesn't need to be configured in any special way. So anywhere that you can host a web page, you can host a podcast.
I would recommend a great place is rmedia.org. Ourmedia.org. And that's a really, really great place because it's actually an online community of people who are sharing audio, video. You can have your own blog essentially on there. And how that works is it works in conjunction with Internet Archive, which is a site that you definitely want to check out because that will host your media files. So you can upload your audio and then rmedia spells it out. If you go to rmedia.org and set it up, it's nice because then you can your blog then points to those files, and then it also generates an RSS. So it saves you the step. Actually, another approach from having to do that is actually if you host your audio on a blog, you have a built-in RSS already, and so that will generate you know, essentially you have your podcast right there, and it's free. So it's kind of nice.
Yeah, there's different approaches for doing it and creating it, and it really depends on what your goal is. In my case, the goal is to actually teach students about not only how to subscribe to podcasts, but what the underlying technology was. And so I really wanted them to get their hands dirty with some of the XML, and I didn't want them, and I didn't want to hide some of, so I didn't want to hide some of the things that some of these other tools do. Back here, just some other software tools for podcasting, most of which are free. We talked about Feed for All and the converter programs. If you want to do some screen capture stuff and post that, Cam Studio is a free screen capture program that will capture all your mouse movements and anything that's going on a screen. So is Camtasia's out there that costs money.
Are those all PC?
These are all PC products.
Snaps Pro, it will work for the Mac.
Snaps
with a Z. Pro X will work. It's from AmbrosiaSoftware.com.
And I put up two programs for PCs as well, for pocket PCs. Show these guys. One is Feeder Reader, which is an aggregator, and the Core Pocket Media Player, which is a media player. And I'll show you those in a sec. So once you got your media done, the next question is, how do you subscribe to it? And it's relatively easy to do it in iTunes or in another aggregator, which is pretty easy to do. I'm going to talk about Pocket PC podcasting for a sec and give a demo of a program called Audio Bay, which is really cool because it's the easiest way that I know of to create a podcast on a Pocket PC. So here is... Okay, I'll talk to this. I'll sit down. Here is a picture of my Pocket PC. And where's the audio jack?
It's on the other side.
There. Now you might actually be able to even hear me. Audio Bay is a product that my IT 101 class at Bentley beta tested last spring, and it was just released in March. It's one-click podcasting for a Pocket PC, and they're coming out with a beta version for cell phones with that have video cameras to do video as well. The way it works is simple. Once you get the thing set up, you item new, and then I can record. Here we are at Media Giraffe. I'm here with Liz. Say hi.
Hi.
And Colin.
Hello.
And there you go. So we're done. So we'll stop that. That was my podcast episode. We'll continue. I'll say hi from Amherst. And give it some meaningful description. What it's doing now is it's uploading the file that I just created to the server that Audio Bay hosts, and that's it. If I were then to go into iTunes or any other program, you can see I've subscribed to that podcast here on iTunes, and I'm going to do an update. And where'd it go? If I have an... Hey, whew, oh good, it worked. And here's my Hi from Amherst podcast, which I could then...
We are at Media Giraffe. I'm here with Lisa.
Hi.
Hi. And Colin.
Hello.
And we are done.
So that's the simplest way to make a podcast in like 30 seconds if you have a Pocket PC and a wireless internet connection. As you can tell, I have a wireless internet connection. I'm cabled up here so you can hear everything. But this is a product by a company called Acro Design Tech. .com, and for Pocket PC users, it opens up the door to podcasting in ways that weren't possible. One of the things that I gave my students to do with this as we were evaluating it was I have them do on-the-street reporting. So, for example, one of the things we had them do was go search for free wireless with a Pocket PC or their laptop, and when they found it, they had to create a podcast episode like this and say where they were and whose wireless they were connecting to and whether the person whose wireless network they were connecting to knew that they were actually connecting, and if so, why were they giving it away, and if not, what did that say about the security of the network? And so they would say, I'm sitting in Harvard Square near the bus station having having a cup of tea and at Starbucks or wherever. But it was just a great way to let them understand how wireless works and use a tool like this to do podcasting. They would interview each other, stuff like that. So that's one tool for podcasting. And this sells for, I think, $25, including the hosting for however long they host the site. One of the things that I had my students do was podcast the class. After I podcasted the class, I realized that they weren't listening to the podcast because no student was going to listen to something that I already said for an hour and a half again. The question that I asked them how long would you listen? The answer was 6 to 10 minutes. And so what I had them do was I divided them up for the second half of the semester and showed them what I just showed you, and then had students work in pairs to create either audio or to create video podcasts of something they learned in class on a given day. And I'll show you one of those. See if this works. So this is one of the first ones where two students talked about how to create a podcast.
Hi, my name is Philip Schneider. I'm Rishi Bauer. And today we're going to show you how to turn a normal AVI file into a podcast. Now, to do this, it consists of three...
Really high quality video, but from a teaching point of view, this gives students the opportunity to really synthesize what they learned and then present it in 7 minutes. And it took the burden off of me of having to create a podcast of something that we actually did in class every single time. And it got the students engaged in the process of doing this and actually using the technology the way it should be. As the semester went on, we found that there was this little bit of competitiveness because they found that this kind of audio, you're catching video this way, wasn't very good. And so then they found screen capture software. And then they found that they can put their picture in the corner of the screen while they were doing stuff on other parts of the screen. And they discovered advanced features of whatever the software that they were using was. Stop. So you get the idea about how that works. And that brought up a whole bunch of questions about what was the impact on attendance and will students listen? And what are some applications of podcasting and how do you actually make use of it in a classroom? And we'll come back and talk about some more of these later on. I think so. Let me stop here and turn it over to Liz, talk about some stuff she's been doing, and then we'll take a whole bunch of questions and conversation at the end.
Colin, did you have something else you wanted to say? I need your VGA cable, though.
Sure. It'll be up
on the wiki. Yeah.
Oh yeah, we'll send it up pretty soon.
And I need your.
You need my audio.
I need your audio too.
Ooh. 1 minute switcheroo here.
Yeah. So while we sit up here, for the first half of the semester, I created podcasts myself and uploaded them. And I watched the server logs to see how many people were actually downloading them. And they went down. And the first week, everybody did, so I showed them how. By the second week, they went down a little bit more. By the third week, it sort of stayed the same. That's because I think it didn't change much. But as the semester wore on, the number of people who listened for an hour stopped. And that's why I wanted to see if the students would actually be willing to create podcasts and listen to them themselves. Number one, it took the burden off me. And number two, it really showed how it gave them a chance to actually interact with the technology in a way that that really amazed them and their friends, as it created this sense of learning that happened outside the classroom, where the students were actually teaching the class outside the classroom.
Okay. Well, my name is Liz, and I'm going to try to get through this a little bit faster because I know we're running out of time. But I'll talk a little bit about my perspective of podcasting and why it's become something where it's become a part of a lot of my courses. I teach media production, I teach sound design and video production and film production, and so it seems logical to do podcasting, but I have a little bit of a different perspective than my students, because when I went to film school almost 20 years ago, we only had 16 millimeter, and I would, you know, I'd spent $10,000 making a film, and the only place that I could show it would be film festivals. And it was really sort of discouraging to spend that kind of money. And it's before the advent of digital video. We were still carrying around 3/4-inch decks. And so, and a lot of that stuff was expensive. And so to be a media producer at that point in time was really difficult on any, you know, regular level. Later on, I ended up working in film distribution for a social and political documentary filmmaker. And it was a little also discouraging that these people were making some wonderful films that no one was paying attention to. They'd sell at public libraries, occasionally BBC or PBS would broadcast them, but they just didn't have the appeal to get out. And so they were sort of reduced to a very narrow audience. And so when I come to my students and they're working on some presumably video or audio production, I ask them to think about the distribution model before the content, to think about where they're going to put it. And I have to sort of frame it through the beginning of the semester to say, you have it so easy, and you just don't know it yet. And what I found in this last year was when I asked students, they all have iPods. They don't podcast, though. They don't subscribe, or it's changing a little bit. I've noticed there's been a shift in the last few months. But they think it's kind of cool, and they like, you know, downloading music and whatnot. But they haven't really understood it as a distribution model for their own work. And so... So I really look at it from the standpoint of, you know, they can have a voice in this society very easily, and not just have a narrow audience like they would in a film festival, but a global audience. And this is something that to me is mind-blowing. I know to them, you know, they don't remember a time before the internet. So I usually have to jump up and down and turn blue in the first couple of weeks. So in the last few years, I really spent a lot of time subscribing to podcasts. I really didn't listen to radio for a long time. And then once I got into a really sort of crazy schedule and really liked some of the radio that was sort of going on, and I was really happy that they offered it for podcasts, because then I could listen to it on my own time. It was that sort of asynchronous way of looking at it that I really responded to. Blogging the same way. But both really were about creating a sense of community. And that's really what gravitated me to trying to implement that with my students. At Bentley College, we're offering a brand new media and culture major, and it's to business students. And so I'm always in an uphill battle a little bit, because I'm teaching non-majors who come in and they think it's going to be really easy and work in production. And I always feel like somehow I may have enlightened a few of them by the end of it in the process. And so so what I have found is... this is an exciting thing for them. A lot of them, you know, Mark has had, I had one of your students this semester, actually, too, over the summer. But my course doesn't necessarily focus on the technology, but focuses on the impacts of being able to produce content for a specific type of distribution, and that there are aesthetics that go with that. I mean, as you said, these things need to be short. I mean, the short film is on the rise again, in a way that just wasn't the case before. And so this summer, I spent some time, when I have the media blog up here, where I feel like the need to connect blogging with podcasting, simply because it still enhances discussion. And one of the things I found in some of my production courses, especially with business students, is their inability to have a crit. They are fearful, most undergraduates are, in criticizing another student's work face-to-face. But for some reason, they're okay on a blog a couple days later after they've had some time to think about it, and it doesn't seem to hurt as much for whatever reason. So for my mass communication course, I started a new blog and asked the students to be, once a week, a number of students were selected to be front pagers, so they had to put up a diary of something that they felt was important to them that was happening in the news. And then the rest of the students would be commenting on it. And I thought it would be really great to carry that over to a new course that I'm teaching this fall, which is a general media production course, where the students are going to be doing a lot of little projects. And I would really love to not have to eat up valuable classroom time in handling crits, where I'm doing a lot of the critiquing and it's not coming from the students. So I thought it would be great to then have the students podcast their work, and that the homework assignment for that week would be that the students, the other students in the class, would be selected to download it, critique it, and then put their critique on the blog. And so this way, it's something about that subscription. Something about, I have a ton of stuff on my faculty webpage, manuals, videos, audio files, you name it. None of them go to it. They just don't. But if you sort of institute that, well, you must, you know, hook in your iPod, or you must, you know, turn on your iTunes, somehow that weekly thing just has a lot. I've had better success as a result of it. And then this way I don't have to spend so much time on critiquing quite as much during class, and that this way they can also really express themselves, which I think some of them do. A lot of the shyer students express themselves a little bit differently, you know, or at least they actually express themselves more when they blog. And so when they're critiquing other students' work by podcasting, it really does have a big difference.
Is that a publicly accessible?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not on the Bentley site, because Bentley uses software that I it just doesn't do. It's not a community-based software blog. They use Typepad, which is sort of the light version of movable type. And what I wanted from my blog was so that students could go to it and could post their own diaries and comment whenever they so chose to do so. With Typepad, it's just me putting something up and they comment on it. And I don't think that's a community. So I sort of had to resort to this and say, look, and then maybe have them buy it. So there's a number of ways that I'm really looking at podcasting. And one of the ways, which is what I have here in my iTunes, I just used a simple microphone. Even though I have access to great cameras and mics and whatnot, one of the other problems that I know I'm going to have with this new course is it's a lot of little software packages that they need to learn. And the biggest complaint I get from students is they feel a little overwhelmed even with one, like Final Cut Pro. So I was very concerned about how to approach this course, because they wanted to do a lot of things and we wanted to do a lot of things in this one course, but I would have to spend a lot of time teaching software. And so what I did, and I just brought in a clip of it, which is to also use podcasting as a learning tool. And so I can go to them and say, okay, your homework assignment for this week is I want you to download, you know, the first, I have three podcast episodes for you to look at. And so watch them before you come in, so that now I don't necessarily, or I can move faster for software demos. So they've already sort of had an introduction, and we have an open lab, which they can actually sit there and walk through it themselves. And so they're not sort of, you know, getting thrown at some software. And so this is just what, my voice sounds terrible in this, but to give you an idea.
Welcome to the Final Cut Pro Getting Started. This is episode one, and this is all about system settings for Final Cut. This could be you. What I would really like to do is avoid having you look like this. The way in which I'm hoping to prevent that from happening is that I will walk you through some very simple steps on starting a brand new project in Final Cut Pro. A number of students are going to be using the Mac Labs, and so it's really important to make sure that no matter which terminal you're at, there is a certain number of settings that need to be gone over to make sure that your project will run smoothly. And one of the first things that you must do, no matter which station you've been at, is to reset your scratch disk. And basically, all that does is tell files.
I've got huge signs exactly in the Mac lab. They never remember.
So the first thing that we're going to do is tell Final Cut where to look. So we're going to go up to the Final
This is
Cut
using
Pro,
the Snaps Pro that just follows the cursor.
Down to System Settings. Go ahead and click on that. What will come up is our System Settings window, and as you will see here, the first tab is on Scratches. And
so you get the idea. And you'll see in iTunes, the climb is MPEG-4, and my running time is no longer than 5.5 minutes. So I know I have to keep them relatively short. And it really is sort of a little helpful for me because now I can spend my time a little bit differently in the classroom going over these things. And they already have sort of a head start on how to do it. And so if some of them have been out shooting, they can already begin. And they can download this at any time. And they always have it as a reminder. They'll have it in their iTunes already. So if they forget how to do something, it's sort of there for them. And there's a few episodes that I have that go over a lot of things that I know that they're going to ask me about. The second way I also use podcasting as a teaching and learning tool is I know we've all experienced students who don't read the textbook. And I get that more in production courses because they feel a little overwhelmed about the technology. And it isn't until I'm in the classroom with them and sort of going through all the technical aspects of it. And so what I sort of learned this summer, because I was teaching a mass communication course and I was offering, had to read George Orwell's 1984, that I found some audio clips of Mike Malloy of Air America Radio reading it. And so I said, I know a lot of you probably read it before, but, you know, download the audio and just get yourself back into sync to read it for the course because it'll be really important. And it actually helped. A number of students ended up rereading it again or read it, and I was really happy to see that. And so I realized that perhaps what I could do, since a lot of textbooks don't have an audiobook component, was to make my own so that I could also then incorporate my own questions, my own comments, why this reading is important, why I'm having you do it, how it's going to relate to the course content the following week. And essentially, the blog that I use and the podcast that I'm implementing for the fall is really about, you know, my students won't forget my class all week. It won't be that they're coming in on Monday and they forget about it and they come back on Monday, and that's why I get some blank stares. And I found that using blogging and podcasting really keeps the course in the forefront of their minds. It's not that the other courses go away, but they really, it becomes a part of what they're doing each and every week. And so I know for a new media and culture major, it is about building this community of new students. And so I just found it to be an extremely effective and very simple thing. And they're also, you know, I'm hoping to get you to come to my class to talk about the technology, but they can right now very simply use iMovie, upload their stuff very quickly, 1, 2, 3, and it's all provided to them by the college. And so I think just getting acclimated to doing that themselves, I think is very empowering for them to realize that they can be very vocal on the web in doing what they want, you know, and saying something so that a lot of people will see. I had a thing from the Pew, The Pew Internet and American Life Project. This is April of 2005, that about 6 million people are listening to podcasts. And that's just audio podcasts, and that was last year. 6 million people. So I can only imagine what the audience today would be like. And another issue for me is also the future of the aesthetics of that video and how well the image is and how good the sound is and how structures will change in the short film format as a result. So I've gone on too long. I know, Colin, you wanted to say a couple of things.
Check. Hello. Hello. It's on. All right. So my name is Colin Rinesmith, and I work at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. And I am a podcaster, which is very cool as part of my job. Wasn't in my job description when I started, but they realized that I had a background in audio and I had an interest in learning about podcasting. So I started doing that. And if it's /audio at the end of the address, or you can just hit podcasts over there.
At the end of this?
It's actually, instead of home, it's audio. And it's, that's all I'm going to say, actually, because we're almost done, and it'd be way more interesting to hear from you all. So I'm happy to ask any questions, or rather answer any questions, about the work that I'm doing at the Berkman Center with podcasting. But I think at this point we've done enough talking, and it'd be great to hear your questions before we move on. So. No. Yes. Actually, and probably a good way to do that is to bring up a picture on my from my blog, on my Flickr account, on my podcasting setup, so you can see that. That might be interesting.
So we can't see that.
Oh,
you gotta tell us the address.
Okay, if you go to flickr.com/photos/Colin Rinesmith, I think you can get there. Because I can show you that way, sort of, what I use.
No E?
Oh, yeah, no, with no E. Both. Both, thanks.
I just lost it. Hold on.
Sorry, I apologize. I am short an adapter, obviously, for my laptop, so it's very frustrating. I know. They have three different types of adapters for three different size computers. It's very
Flickr?
Frustrating.
Yeah, put the E after in line.
No?
Run it with slash.
Yeah, I think that's it.
There we go.
Great.
Okay.
All right. And so it's the top two pictures. So basically, to answer your question, this is the setup that I use to record this is the phone recording setup. So there's two main things that I do at the Berkman Center with podcasting. One is I record weekly luncheon events. We have outside speakers that come to the Berkman Center because this is really a research center at the Harvard Law School. So it's a little bit different from what we've been talking about in terms of podcasting in the classroom, but there is some of that going on actually through the Berkman Center because we clearly have an interest in the internet and podcasting and using these tools both in the classroom and also to. The best part about it is really getting Harvard outside of Harvard, you know, and accessible to the rest of the world. And I can also talk about that more if folks are interested. But I'll just the second part of the podcasting that I do is more in-depth, sort of short, you know, radio type pieces. So. We're working on right now a podcast looking at digital media in education and some of the legal intellectual property copyright issues involved with educators sharing content on the web. When it's legal, when it's not legal, obviously if you're using, for film professors who want to reference film, you can't really do that on the web if it's part of a curriculum that you want to share. If you want to share it with another professor, actually, not even on the web. It's up for debate whether that's legal or not. We're kind of looking at a lot of these issues, and so this rig actually up there is part of a podcast that I'm working on right now, interviewing a number of people that are taking a look at these issues for part of this project at the Berkman Center. So Amanda Mickle, who's the communications coordinator, and I are doing these interviews over the phone, which is great. So I don't know if that answers your question or if you want to hear more or if people have other questions.
Are you also podcasting lectures as well?
Yes, so that's actually if you go to Audio Berkman, that's more of what you'll find will be lectures, these luncheon series events, also podcasts from conferences. So that's what this most recent, we had a conference at the Harvard Law School that the Berkman Center sponsored on essentially digital identity, privacy issues, the future of our identity and privacy on the internet. Should we have, say, a digital identity card that we all have that we can use? You know, a lot of these questions are being asked right now and actually developed right now. So I essentially then grabbed audio from the sessions, worked with the AV department to get a copy of these files, put them on the web. So that was from a conference, and then other recordings are from these luncheon series that we have where we have outside speakers come from all over the world, from on a range of issues, internet issues, and we podcast those. So that's less, again, sort of, you know, in the classroom, but we have a couple of exciting initiatives coming up in the fall where we're partnering with the Harvard Extension School to make a Harvard Law School course. It's called Cyber One, which is essentially cyber law issues. It's just very open, though. Taught at the Harvard Law School, but recorded, videotaped, and then essentially podcast.
We're just starting?
Yeah, actually. But it's actually for this Harvard Extension School class who will be coming on through Second Life. And so I don't know how many of you know about Second Life, but that's kind of a whole other conversation that we can get into. But essentially the point being is then once it gets out into Second Life, then people can actually go teach that course somewhere else. So it's really extending the model of, you know, pushing content out online, having others absorb the concept so they then can teach it themselves or at least reference back to the original source material where it's coming from through podcasting. So it's exciting. It's neat. So we're beginning to look at a lot of those issues. How can we get, obviously, you know, Harvard Law School content off campus, out, more accessible, and I'll just leave it there, I guess.
So those podcasts, if I wanted to, if I found a podcast I thought was really interesting, I could send all my students to go listen to it for homework?
Yes, actually, that's another thing, and that's already being done as well. Yes, absolutely. So through iTunes. Yes, so through iTunes, actually, if you do a search, if you just put in Audio Berkman in the iTunes search field, it will come up. Also accessible from the website, and it is great, actually. I mean, that we should kind of. I'll just kind of bring it back to what we were talking about earlier, asking these questions of, you know, will your students, you know, listen to the podcast in the first place? You know, it's like they'll listen to it if they make it. You know, if they're making podcasts. You know, it's. Why? That's what's exciting, you know, to be making your own media, to be getting involved in this process. It's great. I totally agree with Liz when it's attached to a blog. I mean, again, podcasting is a conversation. That's like it's not radio. It's different from radio, and when it's on a blog, it invites participation. And what an incredible way to in terms of education, to, you know, what you're doing with your class is great. It's really interesting to see how students respond differently when they are able to comment, not in the classroom, you know. And so these are great tools that more educators should, you know, should take advantage of, especially when there is a component of the student having the opportunity to learn how to use these tools to make their own media, to make their voices heard. It's exciting and it is empowering. So
one of the things that one of my students said at the end of the semester, I asked them.
I asked about what did you learn this semester that I might not be able to test you on, and one of the students said, "I was amazed that the world was able to see what we were doing because they really got the fact that it's different than handing in a term paper. It's different than writing something that you know only one person is going to read when you know that your friends are going to read it and you might show it to other people." Whether it's on a laptop or you can put it in somebody's face like this or on an iPod, it's just this whole different level of interest because it's them, and they get the wide appeal of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a generation of
young journalists with that mind thing, I think it's very important. When you talk to reporters and newspapers, you talk to the Washington Post, those who participate understand that the larger audience is global and that the circulation of the print product is limited, and they're the ones that get involved. I use a simple technology at George Mason University, a very simple technology called Town Hall, which allows for discussion blogs, and the students participate in that after every class and offer feedback on what's happened. And they're a lot more conducive to participating in that sometimes than talking to class. So it doesn't have to be a complicated technology. Actually, the simpler the technology, the shorter the learning curve, the better. The thing is, I think, and what Elizabeth was demonstrating is some of these things aren't quite as complicated as they first think.
Right.
But they appear to be for other people who don't know, or for people who aren't in the know, they appear to be much more complicated than they really are. And debunking that myth will only let the technologies have wider spread use. Because as soon as the technology gets in the way, then it's, oh, I can write faster than I can type. Why should I bother?
Yeah. I have to prepare my online journalism students for a late January start in our class. I start preparing them as soon as they register in November with notes. And like Stunt, you get notes at the end of one semester before another semester started. But it's the only way to get, exactly as you say, get the technology out of the way so you can focus on the content, in this case, journalism.
Right.
Otherwise, you end up running a technology course.
Which is what I do, but that's okay. But that's not what you, that's not what you do.
No, I mean, I could offer a whole semester on just Final Cut because it's such a complicated piece of software. But I know I can pinpoint just the very simple things that they need to know. And then I can get on to, you know, I'm more interested in how they're structuring that work as opposed to worrying about if they're doing something right in the program.
Does Bentley offer any courses for adults, say, to go, like a summer program where people could go to learn a Final Cut kind of thing? Has that ever been kicked around? And I mean, you know, we're talking about proliferation of media and debunking the myth and all that stuff. And I mean, it's usually older folks who are more intimidated by the technology. You're talking about, you know, college students being really intimidated by this. It's a lot bigger divide, though.
Right. Well, I'd love to address that really briefly. The other part of my life is I'm president of the Action Coalition for Media Education, the Boston chapter, and that's what my tag says if you run into me. And part of our work is to actually connect people to those tools, people of all ages. So, and one of the things that we really advocate for are public access and community technology centers. Both are places that provide the tools that people, you know, any age can go in, can take classes, can learn, you know, Final Cut for very little money, can become a member. And, you know, I think that public educational and government access gets beat up on pretty badly. You know, it's sort of people, it's the channel you just kind of, you know, you keep going. You go right past it and you go to something else. But I guess I'm really lucky because, you know, I live... I'm actually on the board of Cambridge Community Television. I should say that first. I'm a vice president of the board, and I live in Arlington, but I'm a member of the board. And I am because it's amazing. Cambridge is very lucky to have a community resource like that that does allow anybody with you know, very little money for a yearly membership to come in and learn, take these classes. So I would just throw that out as another resource that's just often overlooked. People don't really think about, you know, public resources that you can go to learn. You know, that people have said, wow, I've gotten a whole education that I didn't have to go to graduate school for or undergraduate. You know, I didn't have to pay for it. It was cheap to have a membership at my community technology center, my public access center, to learn these skills and to begin making your own media. So it's great.
We're just starting it with faculty in other departments, regardless of discipline, who want to incorporate technology into the classroom, and so we're trying to figure out how to do that. We just hired a new staff person to sort of oversee that, to see how we can do that. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But I think there's a lot of interest, but there's also a lot of fear, too. Like, what if it doesn't work out? Or, you know, it becomes too complicated that it becomes overwhelming for the faculty member as well as the student.
That's right. It can be time-consuming.
It is. But teaching production in general is infinitely more time-consuming to me than teaching a theory course. But I always, which is what I did this summer, which is allow students who are even taking a theory course with me to still produce media, to analyze media, as opposed to handing me a research paper, because I got far more out of it. And so, but it's just so much more work to do. But I mean, it's certainly enjoyable, but my husband doesn't appreciate it.
When your students post their work, is it in a place where the greater world can find it? You know, if you searched on Google for a subject that you guys addressed,
this was one that my group, one of the groups, just did. They did a little satire on President Bush in sort of a Daily Show kind of way. And they literally just today, because the class just ended on Wednesday, they finished their videos and they posted them to Google. Mainly because our web server that we normally host most things has been dismantled because we're building a whole new Mac lab. So they put them up there for now. And they did it with relative ease. I had another group, if I can find it, where it was somebody who's studying web design. And they also just built a simple, you know, website. Here they just put up these two images to sort of ask the question of, you know, what is more important here? And, you know, and they wanted to really have, you know, be able to have discussion. She's supposed to put up a comment area where people can comment about some of these articles that they're linking to. She hasn't finished it yet, but yeah. And they did it relatively... And these students had no formal training in video production at all. I pretty much came in and worked the camera, but they had written out the script. They had put it all together and figured out the structure. And I very quickly sat down, taught them very simply how to use Final Cut Pro, and they did it in a week. I've even taught high school students iMovie and digital video. I did a two-week intensive. So they really... certainly gravitate to it, and I think they're always amazed how much longer it takes than they think.
But it's fun, so they don't really complain
too much.
And in my class also, I didn't show them how to use the webcam stuff. I gave them the webcam and said, here, figure it out. And the same with the screen capture software. They just downloaded it and tried it, and they played with it as much as they felt they wanted to.
Which screen capture software?
For PCs, we used Camtasia Studio, which is a trial version, and we used Cam Studio, which is a public domain one, and Snaps Pro is one that Libs uses. That's an APZ.
Looks like that. Stole my husband's license.
Do people have other questions, or are we wrapping it up? Want to move on, or how do we feel?
For high school use, would you recommend PC-based,
even a lot of my students use Windows Movie Maker, and I encourage it. The problem I always run into is formats, based on where they want to place it, if it's on a website, if it's on Google. I mean, everybody's got different specifications. And the problem I have with Windows Movie Maker is it's a very finite codec, and so we have to then run it through, you know, Media Cleaner or something like that to transfer it to some other format. But I've been able to do it with relative ease.
Same thing. We also use a program called PhotoStory from Microsoft, which takes stills and lets you pan and zoom in on still digital photographs to create add music and sound and voice to create a video that you can save in different sizes. And then convert it to whatever format you want to put it in using something else. It's Microsoft PhotoStory. It's a free download for Microsoft.
Mm. For Mac, that would be iMovie?
Probably, yeah. Because I anytime I've ever done it for high school, I've always just used iMovie because it's just so easy.
And
It'll actually just pull in your pics from your iPhoto into iMovie, and you can then also pull in audio tracks from iTunes. So it's actually very convenient.
Yeah, it's when they give me a Windows Movie Video file, and they want to convert it to something else. Then I end up using like Snaps Pro, which will do motion capture. So just between us, if you need those clips off the DVDs, it will capture off whatever's playing on your screen. And it will include audio as well as video. But it comes in pretty handy when you do need to convert something quickly to, like, say, QuickTime. You can just play the Windows Movie Maker file, or the Windows video file, rather, off of your desktop, and then just put the little, if I can get it to come up again.
What's the volume you use?
You can change the settings, and you can either compress it or leave it uncompressed. What I found is if you're using something like Cleaner doesn't recognize the H.264 compressor. It won't recognize the video, won't recognize that compression for whatever reason. I don't know why. And it took me like forever to find that out. I was like, why isn't the video working? But any of the Sorensen, anything like that is fine. And it doesn't look, I mean, even the thing I did that I just showed you on the Final Cut demo, I just did that right off my desktop. And I put the settings at 320 by 240, which is the standard iPod aspect ratio. And, you know, it looked pretty good. And that was with some compression. So
we used Videora and Cuckoosoft and similar results for conversions. And there's a bunch of different programs to do that. I want to make one last thing about podcasting lectures versus, because there's two camps. One is, you know, posting an hour and a half thing that people are going to listen to again. And I think for distance learning, it's a really effective tool. I think for classes where there's a large class where it's not terribly interactive, it's an effective tool. I think for a class that's, you know, twice this size, it's not, if you want to get any bit of interactivity, because it's hard to pick up voices, and it's hard to hear what people have to say. And then one of the reasons why we went with the 5 to 7 minute things was because that's about the length of a song, and which is what people are used to listening to.
I'm just going to add something to that too. I also I am one of those people that learns better through audio and video. And it's also important for educators to remember that they may have students that learn different ways in a multimedia context, and that offering an audio, even the lecture of the class, may be doing a student a great service. Also, I think that can be overlooked, and I totally agree that. You know, just may not be in general, though, if it's a lecture, it may not be that effective versus if they're making something themselves and they have an opportunity to participate in it. But just wanted to make a plug for those of us who are handicapped in certain ways.
One other challenge.
Challenge, thank you.
One of the other sites or issues that some students had with longer podcasts is they're not really searchable all that easily. There's a site, I don't know if anybody's used it, called Podzinger.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there are a number. Actually,
that's worth mentioning, that when you give it your feed, what it does is it'll use some audio to text conversion on it and then try and index it based on the position where the audio is found. Try and index the site. I haven't tried that with my site yet, but I will in the fall, just to see how good it is, and to see if I think a tool like this, especially with longer podcasts, would make them incredibly useful, because then you can search through and say, well, go to the part where they were talking about whatever it was.
So it creates like chapters, or
it creates an index. So you type in a term that you're looking for, and it'll tell you it was found at 3 minutes and 30 seconds, 3 minutes and 50 seconds. Yeah, and that would, so if you're doing longer podcasts, it would be a much more useful thing to do. I haven't run my site through it to see how good it is yet, but I stumbled across this and played around with the indexes for some of the sites that they've already indexed, and it seems to be a useful tool for that.
And it's available in Spanish.
Even better. Are we done? Any other questions, comments, thoughts? We invite you to continue the conversation with us at dinner or out there at the reception.
Or on the wiki.
And we will post the slides as soon as we're
done.
And
also the podcast of this will be available.
Without an index. Thank you all. Thank you.